From KCUR News, this is Casey Kearns, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. On this week's show, a new report measures the relative status of African Americans in Kansas.
This document, it is my hope, will be the catalyst for our beginning that dialogue and moving in the right direction.
A Missouri artist is inspired by medieval printmakers to make a hillbilly Kama Sutra. And an upgrade to a skate park in Penn Valley is drawing skateboarders from around the metro.
Kids' eyes are going to pop out of their head when they see this. You know, it is kind of a dream come true.
Plus, a collaboration between Indonesian gamelan and experimental jazz.
Well, the gamelan, the way they are is the instruments are paired, and I guess they're thought of as male and female, and they're slightly off from each other.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
Most of the big issues this legislative session in Missouri were tied to the state budget, which has been passed and sent to Governor Jay Nixon. That has many political pundits wondering if this last week of the 2012 session will be anticlimactic. But as St. Louis Public Radio's Marshall Griffin tells us, there are still a few hot-button items left to fight over.
Perhaps the biggest unresolved issue this session is workers' compensation reform. The General Assembly passed a bill earlier this year that was vetoed by the governor. It would have barred employees from suing each other over workplace injuries and illnesses and would have restored workers' comp coverage of occupational diseases. The House has since passed another workers' comp bill that includes a proposed fix to the state's financially strapped second injury fund. GOP floor leader Tim Jones says workers' comp reform is badly needed.
They're really causing a great deal of uncertainty in our world, in our employment world, and that's the worst thing you can have in the middle of a recession.
Tom Dempsey, the GOP floor leader in the Senate, agrees.
It's killing businesses. The lawsuits flying back and forth. I continue to hear from businesses in my district about the co-employee liability piece, and it needs to be fixed.
When Governor Nixon vetoed the workers' comp bill, he expressed concern that occupational disease victims would be deprived of financial rewards if their cases were taken out of the court system. But in a letter to lawmakers 2 weeks ago, he indicated he'd be willing to sign the bill into law if it meets certain conditions. House and Senate leaders say those conditions are still being discussed. Meanwhile, economic development has been an issue hanging over the heads of lawmakers for several sessions. Outgoing House Speaker Stephen Tilley hopes that a jobs bill of some sort can be passed this year.
I think the number one issue in the state's jobs and the economy, the House has addressed it year in and year out. We like to see some movement from the Senate. And I think if the Senate wants to work with the House, our leadership team and our caucus will be willing participants.
That appears to be a long shot at this point, as the House and Senate remain sharply divided over the role of tax credits in the state's economy. There may also be a strong push to pass one or more bills dealing with K-12 schools, though the House still hasn't agreed on an overall public school bill. GOP Senator Jane Cunningham of St. Louis County says her chamber may take up a House bill passed 2 weeks ago that would eliminate the so-called last-in, first-out policy for laying off teachers.
And if they hired in Albert Einstein last week, they would have to fire him first, no matter how effective he is. By state law now, they have to fire the last ones they hired first.
Cunningham says the bill would allow school districts to conduct layoffs based on job performance, not seniority. The main obstacle, though, to passing this and all other bills is time. Senator Dempsey says the extra amount of time spent fighting over the state budget could result in fewer bills passing this year than last.
Because of the amount of negotiation that we've put into this budget, the late evenings, there's a backlog of issues, and we're going to do our best to do the business of the people.
Because of that backlog, some lawmakers will turn their bills into amendments and try to tack them onto other bills that are closer to the finish line. One lawmaker who's already done that is House Member Sue Allen of St. Louis County. She added language to a higher education bill that would shut down the Sue Scheer Institute for Women in Public Life at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Several GOP lawmakers accused the institute of being biased toward Democrats and of using state money to engage in political activity. The bill has already passed the House and awaits action in the Senate. The regular session ends Friday at 6 p.m. In Jefferson City, I'm Marshall Griffin, St. Louis Public Radio.
On Wednesday, the Kansas House sent a massive tax-cutting bill to Governor Sam Brownback. Legislative estimates show it could create more than $2.5 billion in budget deficits in the next 5 years. Supporters of cutting taxes say it would help spur economic growth. As Kansas Public Radio's Stephen Caranda tells us, an unusual chain of events led to the bill's passage.
The Senate passed a large tax-cutting bill earlier this session, hoping it would be a starting point for negotiations with the House. But in a surprise move, the House voted to accept the massive bill and send it to the governor. Initially, House members settled in for what was likely to be a long debate on the bill. Tom Moxley, a Republican from Council Grove, kicked off the House debate, saying passing the big tax plan would give Governor Sam Brownback all the power because he could sign it into law.
We are handing the reins of government 100% in this case to the governor.
But not long after Moxley spoke, the debate was cut short.
Pursuant to Rule 2304, I move the previous question.
That's Representative Lance Kinzer, a Republican from Olathe. He's using legislative speak, but he moved to end a debate and force lawmakers to vote on the Senate bill. His motion succeeded. House members lined up on the floor to blast the bill and the process. Bill Fireborn is a Democrat from Garnett.
I've been privileged to serve in this committee and on this floor for 18 years. And not once in that 18 years have we brought a bill this important and limited discussion.
Some legislators tried to keep the vote open, but after a while the move failed. Speaker Mike O'Neill, a Hutchinson Republican, closed the voting while opponents shouted from the House floor.
65 having voted in favor, 58 opposed to the passage of House Bill 2117, the same having received a constitutional majority, is hereby declared passed.
While the House debate played out, the Senate was actually debating a smaller tax-cutting package. But after the House passed the Senate's larger bill, discussion in the upper chamber was cut off. Some members of the House and Senate blasted the move to approve the larger tax bill, saying it would devastate the budget and hurt education and social services. Senate leaders say they only passed the larger tax bill as a starting point for negotiations, not as a plan to become law. Senator Les Donovan, a Wichita Republican, chairs the chamber's tax committee.
The bill that the governor has coming to him now is not what the state needs. It's not what the state can afford. It's not what anybody wants.
House leaders say they were concerned senators would not pass the tax compromise. They say the move to pass the larger tax bill is aimed at pushing the Senate to continue work on legislation. Representative Richard Carlson, a St. Mary's Republican, chairs the House Tax Committee.
The Senate needs to work with the House on a compromise bill, and hopefully they will get back and work toward having good tax reform in Kansas. Otherwise, their own bill will become law.
Under the Senate tax plan that's now headed to Brownback's desk, income tax rates would fall and taxes on income made from certain types of businesses would be eliminated. Governor Sam Brownback says he's prepared to sign the large tax bill, but he wants lawmakers to continue working on tax legislation. If they can't come to an agreement, Brownback could sign the bill into law, causing the biggest tax change in Kansas in recent history. At the Kansas State House, I'm Stephen Caranda.
And speaking of Kansas, how does the status of African Americans compare with that of its white citizens? That's the question that inspired a recent report by the Kansas African American Affairs Commission. The commission was established in 1997 as an advisory group to the governor. It recently partnered with the Kansas Urban League to look at economic, health, educational, and criminal justice indicators. This report will be used to guide strategies and better target funding to address equity gaps between white and black populations. To discuss the findings, Susan spoke over the phone with Mildred Edwards, executive director for the commission.
The state of African Americans in Kansas document has been in development for well over a year. I began with the commission in January of 2010. As a result of my appointment, became interested in if the goal is to decrease disparities and inequities for African Americans, what do we know about the state of the state? wanted to develop a document that provided a baseline assessment of the equity in the state, and the document that resulted was this State of African Americans in Kansas inaugural publication. It's intended to not only provide a snapshot of the black-white differences of residents in five key areas, it also is a tool that would allow us to mobilize communities in an effort to leverage our resources, begin to dialogue and discuss ways in which we could eliminate and work to decrease the inequities identified in the document, and then provide some common language for how we would address those issues as a state.
Now, one of the things you look at is economic opportunity and asset building, and one of the things that jumped out to me is the higher rates of unemployment, which are double for African Americans that of white unemployment. And this is a similar finding, actually, to other cities around the country. What are some of the causal factors, and what do we do about it in Kansas?
Many of the things that the African American Affairs Commission is working to do is to look at some of those barriers to employment. As you know, the items that are identified in the State of African Americans in Kansas document are all interrelated. If we have health issues, that will impact our employment status. That can impact our learning. It could impact our service. It could impact our criminalization rates to a certain extent. If we have issues in many of these areas, the document is intended to show that they are all linked. So our goal is to cog the wheel somewhere. So beginning with unemployment status, if we were to use that as a point of entry, some of the barriers that exist there are criminalization rates. We have a disproportionate number of African-American males in particular that have had some sort of contact with law enforcement agencies that could prohibit employment. We have a limited number of African Americans that have successfully matriculated through a post-secondary education program that will impact employability. We have a number of African Americans that are transient and do not have adequate housing or the stability that owning a home would provide, or transportation that would permit them an opportunity to get back and forth to work. We have limited public transportation options throughout the state of Kansas that when you have low-income communities or communities that have a limited economic standing compared to their counterparts, then they would need supports in order to not only obtain employment, but to retain those positions. And so that's some of the areas in which employment may be impacted.
Well, I did notice that one of the other things you identify is a lower rate of ability to qualify for mortgages. And you point out that, you know, certainly that can be linked to unemployment rates. If you're not employed, it's harder to qualify for mortgages. And you also point out, you know, the education gap with fewer African-American students graduating from four-year institutions. What can we do about that? It seems like you'd have to start early to impact that particular finding.
Some of the things noted in the State of African-Americans in Kansas document, particularly targeting the government realm, would be to regulate payday lending practices and place location limits on payday lending agencies in Kansas, to promote savings programs such as individual development accounts and other savings incentive programs. If we were to look at interventions that would target communities, we could provide community-based supports for low-income, high-achieving students. At the schools level, we could look at working with minority business enterprises to secure discretionary spending opportunities outside of the traditional supply support chains that exist. That would improve economic opportunity and asset building. The final two areas that are systems, perhaps, that we could impact would be within the family and then the individual themselves.
Another striking finding is African-American families, only 43% of them are married in Kansas. And again, these findings kind of track some national trends, but 48% of your families in Kansas are African-American single mothers. Talk about some of the issues behind this, and how do you even begin to address this issue?
That's a difficult challenge. There are a number of contributors to family. When you look at individuals that counsel families and intervene to support families that are struggling, many times or oftentimes the issue is economics. And when you have communities where there's tremendous disparity in the economic opportunities, and then marital situations are greatly impacted by economics, they go hand in hand. Another contribution would be those number of individuals that are impacted by our criminal justice system. It's, you can't retain a marriage oftentimes if you have someone that in the family, a loved one that is incarcerated and not readily available to the family consistently. So once we have that data, we can look at the impact of our criminal justice system on the marital situation of African Americans. When we look at the age of students that are or young adults that are engaging in behaviors that would have them starting families prior to becoming married, it is a national standard that fewer and fewer young adults are choosing to be married. In addition to that, it's more difficult to be married if you have a child prior to becoming a young adult or an adult of marrying age. So some of these contributors are areas that interventions can be created in order to improve the marital rates of the African-American community as well.
So one other thing that jumped out, and this is in the advocacy and civic engagement category, that African-Americans don't vote as often, they're not registered as much in Kansas. And so I wonder what this says about the African-American community as a political constituency. You know, polls show that African Americans are generally Democratic, and is it possible that African Americans then don't vote in Kansas because they feel they might be disenfranchised to some extent since it has strong Republican leanings?
There is a very, very strong contingency of Black Republicans in the state of Kansas, and they're very, very active in our civic and democratic process within our state. Yes, Kansas has historically been a Republican state. I don't know, however, if we are that far off or that disillusioned with our democratic process in the state because of our being a Republican state. I don't know if that's the case. I don't have enough understanding of what is taking place with regard to registered voters in Kansas to make that assumption. We have been concerned as a commission of the impact that the voter ID bill would have on voter registration in Kansas and the populations that will be impacted given the IDs that are being required. Throughout our Advocacy Days events hosted here at the Capitol, during our legislative session, we have trained community organizations that have hosted events to understand the impact of our voter ID law, what it would take to gather IDs or to gain IDs for individuals seeking to vote, what it would take to gather and gain birth certificates for individuals seeking to get IDs to vote, and to provide them with the information necessary. So we've put together panels consisting of the Kansas Department of Health and Environment Vital Statistics, the Kansas Division of Motor Vehicles, the Secretary of State's office to talk about the voter ID bill, along with the NAACP that has been rallying organizations throughout the state, training them to register voters.
Now, obviously, a lot of work has gone into this report, and there's a lot of data presented here. How would you summarize the key takeaways and the key calls for action that this report suggests?
We want to look at if we get it right. What does that look like? Who needs to be involved? And how do we go about accomplishing that task uniformly throughout the state, using the creativity and the gifts that are present at the community level to design those plans rather than using a one-size-fits-all approach that oftentimes limited resources requires that we do. We can do this by working together, and this document, it is my hope, will be the catalyst for our beginning that dialogue and moving in the right direction.
Mildred Edwards is the executive director of the Kansas African American Affairs Commission. Find a link to the report, The State of African Americans in Kansas, on our website at kcur.org.
Coming up, Kansas City finally completes what some consider a world-class skate park. You're listening to Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
A construction site can be a big temptation for skateboarders. So what about a skate park under construction? Well, for the expansion to the one in Penn Valley, the city purposely hired contractors who could deal with kids riding all over their work in progress. The skate park officially reopens Tuesday and is expected to draw kids and adult riders from all over the metro. Sylvia went by one evening last week to check it out and talk to some of the riders testing out the flow.
The sun's about to set on a wide concrete plaza surrounded by orange fencing. Fencing didn't stop the five or six guys and a girl who are riding the ramps, cruising the bowl, and jumping off some of the new obstacles, at least the ones that aren't still encased in wood. A contractor reties some of the yellow caution tape, but John Hernandez says you can't expect skaters to see the concrete and then wait for opening day.
We were like 10, 15 years like skating things they're not supposed to skate, and this guy thinks he's going to like put stuff at a skate park and then rope it off like we're not going to skate it. That's stupid.
This is only the second skate park ever built in Kansas City, Missouri. It opened in 2006, at a time when a lot of residents were concerned that skateboarders were destroying other public places. The $380,000 allocated at the time wasn't enough to finish what the city had planned. Penn Valley Skate Park had some ramps, rails, and a bowl, kind of like an empty swimming pool. And according to Marlena Walters,
it was all right. I mean, it wasn't that great. This is way better.
It was very stop and go. You ran into a wall, you ran into a fence, and it was very much once you got to the end of a so-called line, it was done. That was it. You couldn't skate anymore, which is infuriating to a lot of skaters because it's just, you want to keep going.
Nick Owens owns three skate shops in the area, and at 37, still likes to ride himself. He says now that the park is completed, it finally has some flow.
A well-designed skate park has flow in that you can hit different obstacles and keep going around in different directions and do different patterns and whatnot, but continually skate with, you know, hopefully without falling.
Owen says that almost every local city and suburb now has a place to skate, but he says this will be Greater KC's first world-class park.
Kids' eyes are going to pop out of their head when they see this, you know. It is kind of a dream come true.
That's partly because of these six expensive metal structures. They're kind of like geometric sculptures, painted bright blue and red. They're actually obstacles that were used at a professional skateboarding competition last year at the Sprint Center and were donated by skateboarder Rob Dierdeck's foundation. According to Dierdeck, a great skate plaza needs more than ramps and bowls. It should replicate the urban street environment, stairs, metal rails, picnic tables and benches, the kind of challenges that skateboarders crave. Surveying Penn Valley's park, skateboarder Damon Rodriguez has high hopes.
Looks like a place that things are going to be grinded and boards are going to be flipped and landed on. Goals are going to be completed.
Kansas City Parks and Recreation spend about $300,000 on the upgrades. It's part of a larger set of improvements in Penn Valley Park. They still plan to put in some grading and lights. City officials might not realize it, but the investment in the skate park is attracting at least one new resident, Nick Soper.
I'm pretty excited about coming out. In fact, I'm moving a couple blocks away just to skate it more.
Really?
Yeah.
Where did you live before?
Liberty.
Nick Owens estimates there's about 10,000 skateboarders in the metro area. But he says city officials shouldn't delude themselves that skate parks will keep skaters off the streets.
Maybe some of the younger skaters, but the older skaters, they will still skate parks. But everyone here right now will go skate in the streets. So it's a deterrent, but it's not going to keep them away completely. That'll never happen.
As Nick Soper says, anything can get old.
This is a really bad analogy, but like, it's like a new chick, you know. Like, yeah, you'd never really hung out with her. You don't know much about her.
Hot new chick.
And she's hot, yeah. But it's like,
she's got good transition.
It's good for a while. It'll be good for a while until you really get to know her and you'll be like, man, this is the same old chick. I'm gonna go find a new chick. So that's what's cool about street. There's always something new.
But for now, that something new is going to be at Penn Valley Skate Park. Tuesday afternoon is the ribbon cutting. Star skateboarder Rob Dyrdek will be there. He's also in town for the Street League DC Pro Tour at the Sprint Center Friday and Saturday. If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
Missouri soybeans are exported all over the world, and markets are growing. Reporting for Harvest Public Media, Eva Doe visits the self-proclaimed world capital of soybeans in Norborn, Missouri. She learns how local farmers are building on connections to one of their largest customers.
Here in Norborn, Missouri, about 60 miles east of Kansas City, Ron Gibson has spent his entire life growing soybeans on his farm by the river.
I quit college and came back to farm and have been farming ever since. Just been adding acres as I go.
At age 70, Gibson got to see for the first time where most of his crop ends up. That is, on the other side of the world, in China.
We spent a couple days in Beijing and then went to the Hebei province, which they call that the sister state to Missouri. And they treated us very, very nice there.
Gibson was part of a Missouri trade mission to China last fall. He represented soybean farmers. It was an important role because soybeans are Missouri's main crop, and China is an important customer.
China imports more soybeans than anybody else in the world. Price wouldn't be near what it is if they weren't using all that they're using.
Historically speaking, it's actually an interesting reversal, China buying so much soy from the U.S., soybeans are native to China and have been cultivated there for thousands of years. They weren't introduced to the West until much later. And even then, Gibson says, soybeans didn't take off.
It evolved over the years. It started out as a legume, as a manure crop. You planted it and plowed it under. That was years ago, but it turned out it was such a good livestock feed.
With the discovery of new uses for soybeans, like biodiesel, places like Norborn, Missouri have been turning out more soy. And Missouri farmers are looking to China to buy.
You got to find new demands because the yields are increasing and you don't want to glut on the market. There's
soybeans. In almost every sector, Missouri businesses see opportunity in China. Tim Nowak is executive director of the World Trade Center St. Louis. He says even small local companies are looking overseas.
80 to 85% of Missouri's exporters are small to medium-sized companies. It's not just about the large multinational company.
Missouri exports to China hit new highs last year and are projected to keep growing. During the trade mission Gibson took part in, Governor Jay Nixon signed a $4.4 billion trade deal with China. But not everyone's happy with what's being sold. Robert Scott is director of trade research at the D.C.-based Economic Policy Institute. He points out that Missouri's top export continues to be commodities, such as crops and metals, while its main imports are finished products. He says this trade imbalance will hurt the state in the long run.
Essentially, we're pouring energy on the land and mining the soil for corn with a lot of heavy equipment, and it doesn't create very many jobs. And we're using those products to buy labor-intensive manufactured goods from China.
But as for Gibson with a soybean farm, he sees more opportunity than downside. He says he was struck by something during his visit to China.
I expected everything to be backwards, but the big cities look like just like they do here, only they're huge.
Huge cities filled with potential customers. I'm Eva Doe for Harvest Public Media.
Eva Doe is a journalism student at the University of Missouri, and Harvest Public Media is a regional agricultural reporting service based here at KCUR.
St. Louis-based artist Tom Huck is returning to the subject of his rural Missouri roots, and this time, in a new series of prints, it's a hillbilly take on the Kama Sutra. KCUR's Laura Spencer met up with Huck at a Kansas City gallery.
Tom Huck stands in a small room at Sherry Leedy Contemporary Art, all dressed in black, with a shaved head, glasses, and ropey arms covered with tattoos.
I kind of want two things to happen. I want you to be horrified and shocked, but drawn back in because of the beauty of what's going on. I try to make bad things beautiful.
Like Huck himself, his works, often large-scale, intricate black-inked woodcuts, are full of humor, some with outright graphic accounts of small-town life, like his hometown of Potosi, Missouri, population just under 3,000. Huck's father was the town's chiropractor and a storyteller.
Who knows how exaggerated they were by the time they got to me, but I always had them in my mind, these stories, and when I started making work about myself, those were part of me, those stories.
Missouri life was the focus of Huck's 1998 woodcuts called 2 Weeks in August, 14 Rural Absurdities. The works of social satire touched on issues of racism, violence, and the abuse of authority. Huck turns to his rural roots again in his new series of smaller linoleum prints called The Hillbilly Kama Sutra.
I had been wanting to do a really strong, grab-you-by-the-throat, dramatic set of prints that just are horrifying and funny.
Huck says he was inspired by the work of early printmakers like Hans Holbein's series called Dance of Death. First published in 1537, it's considered a masterpiece of the macabre. In Dance of Death, death steps in at moments of everyday life.
Death is coming no matter who you are, no matter what your social status, no matter if you're the Pope or a beggar, a factory worker or a farmer, death is always on the horizon. It is a common thing. It's going to happen to all of us. Well, sex does too. Everybody does it. And so I saw that link there. Sex is going to be there no matter what.
It's not surprising that Huck credits underground comic book artist Robert Crumb as an early inspiration. But Huck's quick to point out that his new series is not pornography. He says you don't see the action. It's more about the setting as the acts are happening. Here's an example.
I mean, there's a couple that are, you know, doing it on a bed. The springs are exploding out of the bed, but there's a cat cleaning itself on the bed. I mean, you just focus on, you know, the composition more.
Huck says he's mapped out the next 25 years, continuing his satire in a series of large triptychs called Booger Stew. The first in the series, called The Transformation of Brandy Baghead, explored the lengths some go to for 15 minutes of fame through plastic surgery. The 4-foot by 8-foot panels are titled, named, and planned. And Huck says he's ready to get back to work. Laura Spencer, KCUR News.
Tom Huck, The Hillbilly Kama Sutra, continues through June 30th at Sherry Leedy Contemporary Art in the Crossroads Arts District. Photos and a video with Huck can be found on our website at kcur.org. Just click on Arts and Culture.
We We all know Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, a traditional nursery song. But today we have the story of Stella Starlight, a more unconventional piece of celestial music. Dan Warnicke is a grad student in film and theater sound design at UMKC. Last year, he was introduced to Stella, a giant turn-of-the-century music box housed in the Mar Sound Archives at UMKC.
Stella looks like a big turntable that plays rotating metal discs that look like records. A steel comb plucks out the tune from tiny pinholes in the discs. To Warnicke, there has always been something heavenly about music box melodies.
When I was younger, my mom actually gave me a music box. You could take off the cover of the music box and see sort of all the gizmos inside and how they worked. So then when I got my first tour of the Mar Archives here at UMKC, the Stella music box, which caught my attention among all the other music boxes and record players that they have here, and I guess you could say the connection to the machine was made. And a year later, I decided to start taking on this project.
Warnicke created a special disc based on a star chart. The pattern of holes on the metal disc are in the same place as the constellations above UMKC. And, as it turns out, the stars are pretty musical. Our intern, Brenna Daldorf, produced Dan Warnicke's story.
This is the disc called Stella Starlight. This music box is from the early 1900s, so it's a time before they really had any sort of digital recording or anything like that, so the way that they were able to produce music is physically. We didn't have iPods or iTunes or anything like that available. The idea to do it with the star map actually came from my idea from John Cage. His whole philosophy was he doesn't necessarily consider himself a composer of sorts on all his pieces. Some, yes. He wants to let the music be revealed, free of artistic choice and artistic decision. That's where the idea for the disc actually comes in. It's similar to an idea of John Cage in that I want to have this disc free of artistic expression. It's simply a photograph, in a way, taking a picture of the sky and imposing it onto the disc, and then having that be the musical representation of that. This disc in particular is from a specific time and specific location. The date that I chose is January 1st, 2011 at midnight, so the very first stroke of the new year. This is what the stars look like from a specific location, which is the exact longitude and latitude of the Mar Sound Archives at UMKC. In order to emphasize the fact that it is a disc about the constellations, I drew the lines in between them. You are seeing all the constellations that are visible in the sky. The constellations that you have in particular, because it's January 1st, now it's the winter constellations, so some of the important ones that you always see in the sky, the Big Dipper, which is part of Ursa Major, the bear. You have the Little Dipper, which also includes Polaris, which is the North Star. Draco is always in the sky near Polaris. Orion, which is a popular winter constellation. Your horoscope belt is actually right through here. I was quite frankly surprised how musical it actually was. It sounds, forgive the pun, it sounds celestial. One of the beauties of this project is that because it is from a specific time, a specific location, it gives you a specific song. Had I chose another date, it would be a different song. Had I chose another location, it would be a different song. So this disc in particular from January 1st, 2011 at the Mar Sound Archives is essentially a verse of the never-ending piece.
UMKC graduate student Dan Warnicke created Stella Starlight, a disc based on a star chart, which is played on an antique music box. Check out KCUR.org for photos of Warnicke and Stella and a link to a video of Stella Starlight in action.
This story first aired back in October.
After the break, local composers combine Asian instruments with jazz. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, patrons waited for hours on end at Kansas motor vehicle license offices. The Missouri legislature sent Governor Nixon a proposed budget, and the Kansas House passed a whopper of a tax cut bill. Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week on the KCUR Weekend News Review.
The Kansas House didn't wait for the Senate to vote on an adjusted tax cut bill and sent the governor one that the budget office said would leave the state more than $2.5 billion short by 2017. To that, Senate President Steve Morris said,
"It would be devastating to education, to corrections, to social services."
Morris said the Senate bill that passed was designed as a starting point for negotiations. The prevailing story was that Governor Brownback convinced conservative House leaders to pass that bill rather than accept less tax cuts than he wanted. The failure of conservative and moderate Republicans to agree on any state or congressional redistricting resulted in a delay of the filing deadline for coming Kansas primaries. House Speaker Mike O'Neill said the stalemate was over whether the Senate's plan for its districts was designed to protect its moderate majority.
"I respect tradition when it's the right thing to do. I do not respect it when it is used for a bad motive."
Moderate Senate leadership killed a House plan to move up the date when proof of citizenship is required for first-time voter registration. And Democrats like Ann Ma couldn't stop the House from passing a bill called the No Taxpayer Funding for Abortion Act.
"Tax breaks don't cause abortions. Unwanted pregnancies cause abortions. Could we work on that for a change?"
But Senate President Morris cast it aside, saying it would endanger the accreditation of the KU Medical School. The House finished its version of a budget bill that pleased Speaker Mike O'Neill.
"I like the fact that we stayed fairly lean, but did address what I consider to be some of the essential things that we needed to get funded."
But no Democrats voted for the budget. The Missouri legislature finished its budget and in the process agreed on $3 million more for higher education, dedicated funding for veterans' homes, and a scaled-back version of a health care program for the blind with premiums for some and an income ceiling. Republican Senator Jim Lemke said he'd take that budget bill to court.
"Such an action could violate the constitutional restriction that a bill be limited to one subject, Article 3, Section 23.
House Democrats like Sarah Lampe said Missouri needs more revenue.
"I urge you to take action so next year's budget won't be Missouri's version of the Hunger Games."
Lampe called for a tax amnesty program, sales taxes on internet purchases, and higher taxes on cigarettes. The legislature also sent Missouri voters a proposed constitutional amendment that would give the governor more power in choosing appellate and Supreme Court judges. The Kansas City City Council approved the new 3-year contract with Firefighters Local 42. Councilman Jim Glover was one critic.
"I opposed the joining of the ambulance department and the fire department way back in 1999. Didn't think it would work. Don't think the ambulance service has functioned well now."
Glover and Ed Ford voted against the contract. Wrapping up the week, police searched the waters of Indian Creek all week for a sign of Jeffrey Bridges of Overland Park, who disappeared last Sunday after saying he was going to check out floodwaters. Johnson County motor vehicle offices were plagued with problems related to a new computer system all week. Richard Buckley was released from prison after serving 4 years for the killing of his law partner, and Sean Pernice was sentenced to 15 years for killing his wife, who disappeared in 2009. This is KCUR.
For the last 2.5 years, the Black House Improvisers Collective has made its home in an unoccupied floor of a downtown building provided by the Charlotte Street Foundation. There, the loose group of composers and improvisers meet in 3 sessions a year to create original music. About a year ago, the Indonesian percussion ensemble Gamelan Genta Kasturi also moved into the space. Like the Odd Couple, these unlikely roommates have decided to find common ground and work together. They are collaborating on a rare fusion of avant-garde jazz with traditional Asian music. Alex Smith has this story.
For the current session of the Black House Collective, founders Hunter Long and Russell Thorpe gave their fresh crop of composers a new challenge. They were asked to compose music using not just the usual large jazz ensemble, but also incorporating the gamelan. For most of them, this Indonesian orchestra of gongs and xylophones was an unfamiliar but inspiring sound.
My name is Mary Huntemer. I would say it kind of has a wind chime quality.
My name is Russell Thorpe. The first thing that always comes to mind for me is shimmering.
My name is Chris Robinson. I didn't realize how loud it was. It's really kind of powerful sound.
I'm Hunter Long. To a trained Western musician, it sounds out of tune. It's very rhythmic. It's kind of hypnotic.
I'm Terry Quinn. I'd say enveloping. When the entire ensemble starts going, the sound just seems to fill up the room, and there's a waviness to it. So it's kind of like you're floating. I describe it as envelope and floating.
It's a Sunday afternoon, just a couple of weeks before a performance, and this is the first time the entire Black House group and gamelan group have actually practiced together. In front of a giant fifth-floor window, the two ensembles face each other. Pat Conway, who's headed the gamelan for most of its 9 years, begins the rehearsal. He and the other five composers take turns leading the two ensembles through their compositions, but this is the first time they've actually heard their work performed.
Initially, I was very intimidated. I was like, well, that sounds very interesting. I don't know what to do with that. My first impression with it.
Had you worked before with traditional Asian instruments?
Oh, no. This is the first time, and it's really been great because you have so much to work with. And so you have to find out how to get the instrument to work with what you're doing. And so it's been a lot of fun to try and figure that out. And it's been a challenge, and that's why I kind of wanted to do it.
Basically, what we did is we had a workshop, our first rehearsal of this composer's workshop at Black House. Pat did a gamelan overview where we all sat in the gamelan, we all played the gamelan, we all learned about it. And in getting to play it, you kind of get more comfortable with it, understand what it is, what it's not. And then from there, you feel like you can write for it because you've played it.
So what is the hardest part of combining jazz and gamelan?
The intonation, because the gamelan sort of exists in its own little universe of tonality. So like Western instruments with the major and the minor keys, we're all fixed around a very definite pitch. It's A440, and so like if we have the organ gives us A and everybody tunes to that, and then we can have all the chords come out in tune and everything sounds nice and clean and that sort of money. Well, the gamelan, the way they are is the instruments are paired, and I guess they're thought of as male and female, and they're slightly off from each other. So when they play together, it creates this sort of like very wide pitch band that's available, almost like an uncertainty thing. So that's a very shimmery quality.
How do the rhythms, that you're used to in jazz and things, how do those compare with gamelan rhythms?
I tried to stick with what I heard was the traditional gamelan. I mean, I have little experience with gamelan, but from the workshop that Pat did with the ensemble, I heard like something constant was happening, and then there was, you know, eighth notes, so there was like that, and then there was, you know, some of them doing eighth notes. So I wanted to keep that, and I think that was the hardest part of how do I make this fit with what I want to write.
I decided that I'm going to take like a Butoh's band type sound and melody and then find ways to combine it within the gamelan.
I was just trying different ideas on what grooves would work with what I wrote. And so I was listening to, I don't know what it was, some hip-hop thing that had a similar drum part. And I'm like, that would actually work with what I wrote.
Is there anything that you've gotten from this project that you are planning on, you know, continuing to explore, like in later work?
Yeah, actually, my piece, I had to just sort of like stop it, because if I kept working on it, it would have turned into something that would take an hour to play.
I'm Patrick Alonzo Conway, and I'm director of the Gamelan Ensemble. This will be the first time that I've tried to combine large numbers of Western instruments with gamelan. My compositions so far that blended gamelan usually had one or two Western instruments. So I'm interested to continue to see what it sounds like, and would like to approach this. I mean, the possibilities are kind of endless.
The Black House Improvisers Collective will perform in collaboration with Gamelan Genta Kasturi on Friday, May 18th. The concert, which is called The Bell Tree, will also feature dancers and light design. The Gamelan's leader, Pat Conway, was also just awarded a Charlotte Street Performing Artist Fellowship.
Thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with assistant producer Alex Smith. Carrie Coogan is our intern, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.